The headlines: China toughening its language on Taiwan. Beijing warns drastic measures are on the way if Taipei moves towards independence. Another Palestinian family becomes the victim of Israel's much-criticized demolition policy. And the United States and Europe are witnessing new highs in COVID cases as the battle to keep Omicron on check goes on. Our top story for this half hour: China says it will have to take drastic measures if Taiwan keeps pushing for independence. The spokesman for Taiwan Affairs Office says Beijing is seeking peaceful reunification with Taipei, but he warned that China will have to take extreme measures if Taiwan crosses the red lines. According to the official, the situation in the Taiwan Strait could become more complex in the coming months due to foreign intervention and provocation by separatist forces. The United States has been angering China with diplomatic contacts with an arms sales to Taiwan. China considers the island as its territory. We've asked Kim Do-ju, a senior fellow in Pangal Institution, to tell us what has driven Beijing to issue this latest warning. He believes China's stance has to do with Taiwan's politics and the U.S. military actions in the region.
Well, you know, this has been, I wouldn't call it a surprise, because this has been a constant Chinese policy on Taiwan and in relationship with the United States in particular. You know, there's only one China, Taiwan is part of China, and if Taiwan declares independence, and then that means a red line is crossed, and the mainland, the central government will take you know, whatever policies, whatever measures necessary to stop that from happening. So basically, that's the same idea, I think, being stressed by Beijing after seeing, you know, there is overconfidence in Taiwan because somehow they think they endured the support from Washington. They can do something probably drastic toward independence. So there is a danger, I think, Beijing sees for next year, for example, and also for Washington. Remember, Washington is stepping up its military engagement and also official engagement with Taiwan, substantially basically breaking this one-China policy. I think that's basically the sense, you know, from Beijing. There is a danger, and there is a looming danger over the Taiwan issue over there, over, you know, island politics and also from Washington. So that's a response.
In this segment of the program, another Palestinian family has just become homeless. An Israeli bulldozer has destroyed a house in a town nearly occupied Al-Quds. We're learning that protests broke out in Jabal al-Mukabir during the demolition. Israeli forces used rubber bullets and tear gas to push back the Palestinian protesters, injuring several of them. Israel regularly raises Palestinian structures, saying they lack construction permits, but Palestinians say those permits are impossible to obtain. The UN has reported a 21% increase in the number of Palestinian structures that were confiscated or destroyed this year. Palestinians say the demolitions are part of Israel's efforts to make room for illegal settlements. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent, Mona Candil, who's with us from Ramallah. Also joining us from London, we have journalist and political commentator, Mr. Said Mohsen Abbas. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Mona in Ramallah. Bring us up to speed on this recent home demolition carried out by the Israeli regime in Jabal al-Mukabir.
Well, there was the house that was destroyed in Jabal al-Mukabir in East Al-Quds, and then there's another demolition just took place in another area also in Al-Quds, in Silwan, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. What happened is that Israeli forces with the bulldozers raided Jabal al-Mukabir this morning in order to destroy a home belonged to in al-Bashir family, because the Israelis say the house was built without Israeli issued permits. The owner of the house tried to convince and has been trying to convince her to give her more time. He was doing his utmost to get Israeli issued permit for the construction, despite the fact that it was built on his own land. However, the Israeli authorities refused. He tried to convince the soldiers that he himself would bring a bulldozer and destroy the home in order not to pay high fines, because in Jerusalem Al-Quds, if the Israeli soldiers bring bulldozer and destroy Palestinian homes, then the owner of these structures would have to pay high fines for the Israeli authorities for the demolition. But they rejected. The clashes took place in Mukabber. A number of Palestinians inhaled gas and suffocated in Silwan. Also, the Palestinians had been attacked for trying to prevent the Israeli soldiers not to destroy another.
Right, let's bring in Sayed Mohsen Abbas in London. Sir, talk to us about the land grab and home demolition policy of the Israelis. UN has reported a 21% increase in the number of Palestinian structures that were confiscated or destroyed this year. Unpack that for us, please.
Well, first of all, this is completely in line with Zionism's settler colonial movement concept, you know, transforming an Arab country, Palestine, into a Judaized Zionist entity. So this is just part and parcel of a whole range of things which Israel gets up to. But it's particularly obnoxious that this actual demolition of houses is really, I mean, it's been criticized by human rights organizations as a form of collective punishment. And therefore, it's technically a war crime under international law. That's the first thing that has to be, you know, alarming to anybody neutral looking at this situation. And then, of course, the facts on the ground. 52,000 homes were totally demolished in the wake of the Nakba in 1948. And since then, of course, you know, there's been a never-ending destruction of these homes. 530 entire villages, towns, and centers, urban centers, were destroyed as well since that period. And the systematic demolition of Palestinian homes, mosques, and other buildings is just almost like normalized now. The fact of the matter is that just this year alone, it's claimed that over 15,000 plus homes have been targeted. I think 30%, there's a statistic I got, which was 30% of East Jerusalem's Palestinian homes are listed for destruction. So this is a massive campaign, and it's all part of trying to make space for Jewish extremist settlers to come in and replace Palestinians. It's psychological warfare, it's terrorism by any name other than, of course, that usual reference we give to terrorism, which is using guns and violence. They do use punitive housing demolition. They use military excuses for housing demolition, i.e., oh, we're looking for potential Palestinian resistance fighters, and if their families are connected, they'll terrorize the entire neighborhood in this way. So the administrative aspect was mentioned earlier by my colleague there, and she rightly points out that actually the laws, the way they are set out in Israel, are discriminatory, and there's no chance that these Palestinians can actually get these demolition orders removed or to go ahead and live in any normal way. Can you imagine trying to live day to day, trying to plan anything, knowing that your very home is under threat? I mean, how on earth is any human being meant to be able to deal with their lives as a family? This is a massive human rights violation.
And a quick question for Mona. Mona, how do Palestinians feel when it comes to the international silence regarding the rights of the Palestinians?
Palestinians continue to demand the international community to act, not only to condemn what's going on, or to call on Israel to stop its aggression and to stop it. They want for the national community to translate its statements into acts on ground to impose sanctions against the Israeli regime. This is what would help the Palestinians to regain their rights, and this is what would help to end the aggression and its aggression, of course.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for this edition of the program. Thanks to Mona Kandil joining us from Ramallah. Also thanks to journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbo speaking to us from the British capital, London. Welcome back. Yemen says it's a great crime for the United Nations to remain silent about the Saudi coalition's latest airstrikes. The targeted Sana'a International Airport Minister of Transport, Amer al-Marani, says the UN has to either confirm or reject the Saudi claim that it had been informed of the attacks beforehand. About 10 days ago, coalition warplanes bombed the Sana'a airport, claiming that it was being used for military purposes. The al-Marani says this is nothing but a justification and is urging the UN and international media to investigate those claims. The attack caused severe damage to the facility and a halt to its few but much needed aid flights. The flights were resumed on Tuesday, but temporarily. The Sana'a airport has been put under a blockade since 2015. Right now in Vienna, a meeting is underway between Iran's top negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani and the EU envoy to the talks, Enrique Mora. The meeting is part of the new round of the negotiations that are going on with a focus on the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. Now crossing over to Vienna, where our correspondent Toma Lezgi is standing by to hear from her about what's new about the talks. Toma, what do you have to share with us?
Yes, Mario, as you said, today we had a bilateral meeting between the Iranian lead delegate, Mr. Ali Bagheri-Kani, Iran's deputy foreign minister, and the EU coordinator, Enrique Mora, at the Palais Coburg. Mr. Bagheri has still not left the hotel. We are assuming that the meeting or meetings are still ongoing. We also yesterday had various bilateral and multilateral meetings taking place between various sides, and the working group that's focused on the nuclear measures that need to be taken by Iran also convened yesterday. And the Russian ambassador in a tweet also yesterday said that he believed that indisputable progress was being made, and he said that he also had the Russian side a very useful and positive meeting with the three European representatives, Britain, France and Germany. And this, of course, is seen as a good sign that indeed these negotiations are moving forward. Sources close to the Iranian team also confirming that the negotiations are moving in the right direction. We also heard the Iranian foreign minister, when he was asked about the process of talks, also not sounding at all pessimistic about them, and saying that he believes that if the other side, specifically, of course, this means the US and the three Europeans, do show seriousness, determination and good faith, then he believes that these talks can actually bear fruit. But how long is it going to take? Some speculating that these negotiations could continue until February, that maybe by then we could have a conclusion or a restored JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action that was signed in 2015 and from which the US withdrew under the Trump administration in 2018. But no deadlines, no set timetables have been officially announced, and I think none of the participants believe that it is useful to do so. The Iranian team has said that we are willing to stay on in Vienna for as long as it takes, as long as we believe that these talks are moving in the correct direction. What Iran wants is, within the context of sanctions removal, verification and guarantees. And these are issues, proposals that were put forward by the Iranian team at the beginning of the seventh round, the previous round. And it was confirmed, of course, in this round that both issues, the verification of sanctions removal and guarantees that the US would not withdraw from the JCPOA again or impose sanctions that violated, are up for discussion. Because this round we're hearing is no longer about what the agenda is or what the modality of the talks is, but is more about content. So basically all sides zeroing in on the important sticking points, which of course, with a focus, of course, on the issue of sanctions removal. Iran has made it clear, and in when we talked with Mr. Barghari, he also emphasized this point that Iran is ready to go back to its nuclear commitments, but only after, he said, the U.S. sanctions are removed, and then Iran verifies that sanctions removal. But what are the frameworks? So what are the criteria involved, or how is this verification process going to take place? Or can the U.S., is the U.S. willing to give guarantees to the Iranians? How is that going to be happening? Can the U.S. President, the Biden administration, guarantee that other administrations after him will not withdraw? Is that possible, considering the role that the U.S. Congress has, etc.? These are all questions that are now going to be up for discussion in this round. There was a comment from the Russian ambassador Ulyanov earlier when he said this eighth round could presumably be the final round. This is an indication that the sides at least are determined to continue these talks with the hope of reaching some kind of a conclusion. We'll have to see if that is indeed possible. At the moment, we know, of course, that these talks will be ongoing tomorrow as well, but there will be a three-day hiatus or break because of the New Year's. And on Monday, they'll be back at it, so within the still the framework of the eighth round. So these negotiations are going to be ongoing at least some time yet.
All right, thanks a lot, Homa Lezgi, joining us from Vienna. Moving on, the coronavirus is again spreading fast in the United States, setting a new record high as the Omicron strain quickly takes hold throughout the country. There have been more than 441,000 infections in one day, up from a daily record of 294,000 cases last winter before vaccines became widely available. The steep rise has led to long lines at testing sites and sold-out rapid tests at many stores. The Christmas holidays shuttered testing places, also leading to a spike in demand. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, however, says the daily case load is likely an overestimate due to lagging state reporting. It says accounts will become more stable after the new year. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
If the truth is not clarified today, the place of the oppressors and the oppressed will be changed. December 12, 2021. This is the part of a speech delivered on December 12, 2021, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in meeting with a number of nurses and the families of those martyred while working in the health profession.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and upon his pure household, particularly the remnant of God on earth. I would like to congratulate each and every one of you, dear brothers and sisters, and the honorable, respected activists who work in the health profession on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Hazrat Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, and Nurses Day. This meeting is a good opportunity to speak about the defenders of health and the dear nurses. But before that, I deem it necessary to raise few points in honor of the great lady of Karbala, Hazrat Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Many discussions have been held and many complimentary remarks have been made about Zainab al-Kubra, which all have been correct. But there are two important points that may be seen in the life of the great person that I wish to discuss here. The first and foremost point is that Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, showed the great spiritual and intellectual capacity of women to all of history and to the entire world. This is very important. Despite the foolish wishes of the people to humiliate women at the time, and those who are doing so in our time, Zainab al-Kubra was able to show the highest status of women and the great psychological, mental, and spiritual strength of women. I will give a brief commentary about these points. When I said that they are humiliating women today, this is a fact. But I do not want to enter into that discussion now. More than anyone else, it is the West who is humiliating women in a dangerous way. The great person, Zainab alayhi salam, showed two points. The first point is that women can be a vast ocean of patience and endurance. And the second point is that women can be a peak of wisdom and prudence.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Desmond Tutu, South Africa's anti-apartheid icon, died on Sunday at the age of 90 after a protracted fight with prostate cancer and infections in a hospital in Cape Town. Tutu was the first Black Anglican Archbishop of South Africa. He labored relentlessly and nonviolently to bring down South Africa's brutal, decades-long apartheid dictatorship that oppressed its black majority, which ended in 1994. He was noted not just for his part in bringing an end to a dark chapter of racial discrimination in his country, but also for speaking out against injustice across the world, notably in West Asia. Tutu was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984 for his nonviolent opposition to apartheid. A decade later, he witnessed the ends of that regime. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said Tutu's death marks another farewell to a generation that has struggled for the liberation of South Africa. He described Tutu as a man of extraordinary intellect, integrity, and invincibility against the forces of apartheid. Ramaphosa added that Tutu was also tender and vulnerable in his compassion for those who had suffered oppression, injustice, and violence under apartheid, and oppressed and downtrodden people around the world.
You know, there's a number of things that leaves behind. One is that particularly during the anti-apartheid struggle, he showed and demonstrated the relevancy of black theology and African theology onto the situation, onto the context. He was able to help define the struggle, not in a way in which someone who was an oppressor would define it, but in some ways of someone who was struggling against the oppressor and against oppressive theology. I mean, he was very much a backbone of the anti-apartheid struggle. His voice was clear and clarion, and obviously he used the weight of his religious office, his ecclesiastical office, to elevate the issues around apartheid and the need to dismantle it.
Tutu was also an outspoken critic of Israeli crimes against Palestinians. He believed Palestinians have been subjected to Israel's systematic humiliation, similar to the one practiced in apartheid South Africa. Archbishop Tutu was an outspoken critic of Israeli occupation in Palestine and the siege on Gaza. He compared Israel's treatment of the Palestinians to the apartheid regime that discriminated against blacks in his native South Africa. Tutu led a UN fact-finding mission to investigate a November 2006 Israeli attack on Gaza's Beit Hanun district that led to the deaths of 19 Palestinians, including 7 children. In a May 2008 statement about his mission, the Archbishop decried the Israeli siege on Gaza, in place since 2007, as a gross violation of human rights. He also said the Israeli siege contradicted the Jewish and Christian scriptures, most recently in an article published in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz in 2014. Desmond Tutu declared his support for the international movement of boycott, sanctions, and divestment as a peaceful means of opposing the Israeli occupation.
Well, I mean, he related what was going on in Palestine to what he had struggled against in South Africa, which was, again, apartheid, or the separation of people, or segregation, as we call it in this country, and Jim Crow in this country, apartheid there in South Africa. He saw it, he recognized that. He said basically that it was no different, and in fact, what was going on in Palestine was just as bad, if not worse, than what was going on had gone on in South Africa. And so it was clear his eyes were eyes that were seasoned in the struggle. When I say seasoned, had gone through it, was able to recognize the dynamics of it, the violence of it, the racism in it, the white supremacy that existed in it. And he called it for what it was. That did not win him a whole lot of friends in those ranks, but because of who he was, the weight of his words and his perspective could not be denied.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu's death on Sunday sparked tributes from world leaders. Pope Francis sent his condolences, hailing his peace-building efforts. UN Chief Antonio Guterres hailed Tutu as an inspiration to generations worldwide and unwavering voice for the voiceless. The United Nations General Assembly has backed an open-ended war crimes probe against Israel, including into the regime's recent 11-day war on the besieged Gaza Strip that killed at least 260 Palestinians, including over 60 children. An overwhelming majority of 125 countries voted in favor of the investigation. It was initially approved by the UN Human Rights Council in the aftermath of the Gaza War in May. The inquiry allows for a review of Israeli human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories. No such open-ended investigation has ever been launched against any other UN member. The vote came after Israel's amendment to defund the probe was rejected 125-8 with 34 abstentions. Israel itself and the United States were among the few that voted against the approval of the budget for the investigation. Palestine's permanent ambassador to the UN, Riyad Mansour, praised the vote and all the countries that rejected Israel's proposal. He thanked the UN General Assembly for approving all budgets of the programs relating to the Palestinian cause, including his request to increase funding to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees. Meanwhile, the U.S. envoy to the UN, who voted against the probe, said Washington will continue to oppose the investigation and to look for opportunities in Geneva to revisit its mandate. This is another example of how Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel despite its blatant crimes for decades, giving it a sort of impunity to get away without any prosecution. This has been done through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes. Speaking of vetoes, the United States has vetoed dozens of United Nations Security Council resolutions critical of Israel, including at least 53 since 1972. Washington's unequivocal support of Israel has seen it thwart resolutions condemning violence against Palestinian protesters as well as illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank built since 1967. The U.S. has vetoed at least 4 UN Security Council resolutions condemning Israel's settlements on Palestinian land, which are considered illegal under international law. The U.S. support of Israel also has encouraged settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis.
Israel will prevent participation by people, by investigators. I don't think Israel will allow them into the country, whether it's this year or next year. As long as they have the backing of the United States, they continue to be able to refuse to deal with international condemnation and international investigation of the undoubted crimes that go on a daily basis against the Palestinian people.
Last week, to mark the 5th year since the UN Security Council passed a resolution calling for an end to all settlement activities in the Palestinian territories, UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Michael Link, issued a statement calling on the international community to hold Israel accountable for its occupation of Palestine. He stated that one statistic above all illustrates the remarkable reluctance of the international community to enforce its own directions respecting the Israeli occupation. According to his statement, when Resolution 2334 was adopted in 2016, there were an estimated 400,000 Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank and 218 in East Al-Quds. 5 years later, there are 475,000 settlers in the West Bank and 230,000 in East Al-Quds, an increase of 12%. The surge in the number of Israeli settlements in the occupied territories shows how Tel Aviv ignores the 2334 resolution that states Israeli settlements constitute a flagrant violation under international law, and that all settlement activities in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Al-Quds, must immediately and completely cease.
What allows the State of Israel to ignore the UN, many UN resolutions condemning the actions taken by Israel against the Palestinians on many different fronts, what allows Israel to continue to do that is the support that it has from the United States, that it's under the umbrella of United States protection. It's almost like Israel is the 51st state of the United States, the way that it's treated by the U.S. government. And this goes through Republicans and Democrats over the years. And so what it's done is it allowed these atrocities to go on
Concluding his statement, the UN official said only an approach based on accountability, equality, and full rights for all can create the possibility of a prosperous and shared future for Palestinians and Israelis alike. But Tel Aviv has invariably avoided all attempts at bringing it to account over its decades-long aggression against Palestinians and other regional nations, thanks to staunch support by its oldest and strongest ally, the United States.
Prison is a disturbingly common experience for Palestinians. Since 1967, around one-fifth of Palestine's population has, at one time or another, been imprisoned. But the issue of Palestinian prisoners went viral on September 6th when the alarm at Israel's heavily guarded Gilboa prison went off following a jailbreak by six Palestinian inmates. Israeli authorities launched a manhunt for the inmates and toughened the situation for the rest of the prisoners, which prompted protests and hunger strikes that lasted for weeks. The spotlight, however, fell on six hunger-striking Palestinian prisoners who were protesting their detainment without any trial under an Israeli policy dubbed administrative detention. On November 7th, some 4,500 Palestinian inmates went on a day-long hunger strike in solidarity with the six. Two of the hunger strikers, who had refused to eat for over 3 months straight, were later released. The strikes have shed new light on the plight of Palestinians in Israel's massive prison system, which currently holds over 4,500 political detainees and inmates on dubious charges. On top of that, Palestinian residents have been subject to violence by Israeli settlers who remain immune from any consequences. If anything, like the raid on the Palestinian village of Jalud in mid-May, Israeli troops come to the aid of the settlers and arrest the victims, not the aggressors. Rights groups say violent settlers are just another tool in Israel's inventory to remove the Palestinians from their lands. Their population is growing fast as the number of settlements built and planned to be built on the occupied territories are rising sharply. Israel pressed ahead with its land grab and expansionist policies like the many years before. It has razed, forced people to demolish or seize multiple Palestinian-owned structures, including in East Al-Quds. In fact, such practices by Tel Aviv increased about 21% in 2021 compared to the year before. Israel has been increasingly evicting Palestinians from their homes, arguing that they lack permits. But it's virtually impossible for the Palestinians to obtain permits in areas including Area C and East Al-Quds. The evictions are usually done on such short notice that the residents cannot take the matter to the court. The United Nations says Israeli authorities have refused to grant permits to at least a third of Palestinian homes in East Al-Quds, potentially placing over 100,000 residents at risk of displacement. Israel's plans to evict several families from the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, however, sparked an outcry that reverberated across the international community. Protests against the plan, especially those around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, turned violent, with Israeli troops cracking down on Palestinian demonstrators and storming the holy site in early May. That coincided with the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. The tension sparked a conflict between Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip and the Israeli military in what turned into an 11-day war on the besieged enclave. The Israeli army razed several structures in the Strip, including a high-rise building that housed the office of several media outlets in Gaza, including the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. The Israeli atrocities drew widespread condemnation, with people around the world holding rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Some observers believe the war was a distraction from a lingering political uncertainty in Israel and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's decision to postpone parliamentary elections that could have been a referendum on his rule. 2021 was a tragic year for Palestine. The events that unfolded over the past year proved that despite what some Arab nations claim, their normalization with Israel did not help the Palestinian cause, but might have even emboldened Tel Aviv to escalate its aggression on the Palestinians. The past year, however, was a year of unity and solidarity too, with Palestinians concluding that resistance is the only means to truly stand against the occupation and fight for freedom. The incidents and headlines in the past 12 months also raised awareness for more people across the world of how life is like for a Palestinian.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says the Islamic Republic will continue sanctions removal talks in the Austrian capital with seriousness. The Iranian Foreign Minister emphasized that Tehran will never give excessive concessions to the opposite side. Iran's Foreign Minister then criticized non-constructive stances taken by some European signatories to the nuclear deal with Iran during the previous round of talks in Vienna. In the previous negotiations, the positions taken by some European countries, especially by the French, were in general not constructive. We expect the French side to focus on playing a constructive role and help the progress of the negotiations. He also criticized the European side for not putting forward any new initiative in the talks.
I think the Europeans proved that they are unreliable since 2018 and throughout 2021, because when President Donald Trump rejected the JCPOA unilaterally, the European states who signed the JCPOA did not honor their signature and did not commit to what they have agreed upon with Iran. Therefore, it is absolutely clear that Iran cannot rely on the European states, particularly now we're talking about France and Germany, including Great Britain, that is no longer part of Europe, but it is within the European continent and it's one of the countries that signed the JCPOA.
The top Iranian diplomat recommended that the five remaining signatories to the JCPOA should have no doubt that if they want to give one concession and get 10 concessions in return, the Islamic Republic of Iran will never accept such an approach. The other parties are continuously doing interviews, saying that they are worried about the progress of Iran's nuclear program. We announced it loudly that if you want to alleviate your concerns about Iran's peaceful nuclear program, all JCPOA-related sanctions against Iran must be removed. The Islamic Republic of Iran will continue its strong talks in a logical manner until a good deal is reached. The European Union's Deputy Foreign Policy Chief Enrique Mora, who represents the bloc in the Vienna talks between Iran and the P4+1 group of countries, and the EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell, are reported to be making efforts to focus on the negotiations with seriousness. Iran and the five remaining parties to the JCPOA resumed talks in Vienna on November 29 after a five-month hiatus, marking the first round of negotiations under President Ebrahim Raisi's administration and the seventh overall. During the seventh round of the Vienna talks, Iran presented two draft texts which addressed separately the removal of U.S. sanctions and Iran's return to its nuclear commitments under the JCPOA. Iran and the P4+1 group of countries resumed the talks at the Austrian capital on December 9, when the participants returned to their capitals for additional consultations on the two draft proposals that Tehran had put forward. Since the U.S. administration under Donald Trump pulled out of the JCPOA in 2018, the EU refused to play a constructive role to revive the deal. The European side pledged to do business with Iran through a mechanism which came to be known as the Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges, or INSTEX, but the project ultimately failed due to the inaction of the European side and U.S. pressure, leaving Iran with no options but to scale back its JCPOA commitments within the limits of the deal. Meanwhile, the European Court of Justice has said that European companies can end contracts with Iranian firms pressured by U.S. sanctions if upholding the deals would lead to disproportionate economic loss. The judgment from the court in Luxembourg was prompted by a lawsuit from the German branch of Iran's state-owned bank Meli against Deutsche Telekom after the telecommunications provider terminated a contract with the bank in 2018 prior to its expiry.
The position of the European court, it's an indication that Iran cannot trust to sign any future deal with any European company, because although the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg accepted the lawsuit forwarded by the German branch of Iran Bank, mainly against the Deutsche Telekom. However, the decision of the European Bank is shameful.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ya Mawlai Musa ibn Ja'far wa rahmatullah.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. As you well know, dear listeners, Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. We find in the history books that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was intentionally arrested and he was thrown into dark prisons where he remained for many years. We also find in the history books that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was put under some of the most severest of tortures and they made him suffer from pain and misfortunes. But the beauty and the behaviors and the akhlaq, the morals and ethics, and this perseverance and patience and steadfastness of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam resulted in that despite these trials and tribulations and tortures and imprisonment and pains and misfortunes and sufferings, Imam al-Kadhim never grumbled, nor did he complain, nor did he whine, nor did he show any impatience towards all that befell upon him. And rather, Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam showed gratitude to Allah. He praised and worshipped Allah more than even the people who weren't facing all of these different calamities and tragedies. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam thanked and praised Allah for giving him the time and the dedication to serve and obey Allah. These are the dialogues of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام إن أصبركم على البلاء لأزهدكم في الدنيا.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, verily he who is most persevering in the face of adversity is the most abstemious from among you.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. When talking about the beautiful conversations of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, this seventh divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Holy Prophet, we find, dear friends, that not all conversations are between two human beings. Sometimes the most beautiful of conversations are those which we have with our Creator, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So in this regards, we find that during the era of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, there was this tyrant and this oppressor and this cruel king who ruled at this time. His name was Harun al-Rashid. This oppressive and cruel and cold-hearted king of the Abbasid Caliphate, he threw Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam into prisons, dark prisons, solitary confinement prisons. But despite this historical fact that Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was thrown multiple times into prison and prisons in which he was tortured and he suffered, we find that Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam devoted himself to the obedience and the worship of Allah to the extent that Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim dazzled and perplexed the intellects of all who were aware of this phenomenon. It is said by the reports of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam's friends and even his enemies that Imam al-Kadhim thanked Allah the Mighty, the Exalted, for giving him free time to worship him. Meaning, when Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim was thrown into prison, instead of crying and complaining and whining and fighting Allah. On the contrary, we find that Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam thanks Allah, because it is Allah the Mighty, the Exalted, who has given Imam al-Kadhim free time to worship him. What a radically different way. What a beautiful and divine way. What a pure and holy way to view the world, and a beautiful perspective on the conditions that one faces. And so in this one conversation, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam says to Allah, Ya Allah, you know that I used to ask you to give me the free time to worship you. O Allah, you have done that. You have answered that prayer. To you, Allah, be praise. What more can be said about this beautiful Imam that emanates from this beautiful conversation of this infallible? May Allah help all of us to follow in the footsteps of this great infallible Imam. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment I want you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Mansur Dawaniqi summoned the Imam with the intention of killing him. When Imam entered Baghdad, he himself went forward and welcomed the Imam and mentioned that I had a dream of Amir al-Mu'mineen, of Ali ibn Abi Talib. And in this dream, I saw that he was reciting a verse of the Quran. And then after that, right after that, Mansur inquires the 6th, 7th Imam. He says that, are you going to revolt against me? Then Imam replied that I have no such intention of revolting against you. The Khulafa were always in fear of losing their power because their Khilafat was not on the hearts of people. The Khilafat of the Masumeen, the Khilafat of the Imams were on the heart of the people. They governed the heart. They were the rulers of the heart because of their Sifat, because of their qualities, because of their behavior, because of their akhlaq, how they were, because of their knowledge. As we all know, that the scholars who lived during the lifetime of the 7th Imam, they praised the Imam. He was known as Salih. Another title of the Imam, of the 7th Imam, is Salih, the righteous one. He was profoundly known for his spirituality, for his generosity, for his knowledge, for his enduring patience.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
In the beginning of April 2011, the Syrian army was ordered to intervene after an increase in armed attacks on security forces in the city of Daraa. But it's safe to say that ordering the army to the streets was a hasty decision, because the intervention of military forces not only did not improve the situation, but also complicated it.